you want me to be the fascist. And once again, the irony of this is that's such a fascist tactic.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know what, that's a really great point, because, you know, in this strong desire to have this enemy, this perceived outgroup, the fascist, they've created, in a sense, they've created their own outgroup to fight against, and now you're it.
I'm Lee Meller. I'm an investigative criminologist, just finishing my dissertation for my PhD. I'm the published author of 5 books, going on about 8, all on the topic of crime, from serial killers to sex crimes to terrorism. I'm a criminal profiler working pro bono with the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases, host of a podcast called Murder Was the Case.
Can I ask you, in regards to what you just suggested then, what got you into the kind of free speech stuff?
I think that I took it for granted. I took this idea that we were free to express ourselves once we were grown adults as just something that was non-negotiable. Like, I didn't even cross my mind that this would ever, in the West, be an issue. And all of a sudden it was. And it was almost as absurd. It was the most absurd thing I'd come across. It's like, what do you mean we can't say that? Not like, please don't say that, but you legally can no longer say that. Then all of a sudden, it became just, I found myself warped into the middle of the most important civil rights battle that just unexpectedly, you know? So it wasn't something that I actively got involved in. It's like the world changed around me. Do you feel where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah, and I'm wondering if what you just said is not, could you please not say that, but you can't legally say that. I wonder if that was something that was happening in Canada a little bit before everywhere else, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I suppose it came in with like this idea of hate speech, which I didn't really give it much thought until Jordan Peterson started speaking about the use of gender pronouns and this idea of mandatory speech, right? So, because I'm not a person that generally goes out and says hateful things in the context which I understood them to be applied legally, so I didn't really think too much about it because I wasn't going to go off on the Holocaust didn't happen sort of thing, right? It's just not something that occurred to me. But then when it started becoming an issue of you have to say this, it's like even if I agree with you're compelling me to say, the fact that you're trying to compel me to say it is where I disagree.
I think that's a really important point you just made. Is it's very frustrating when you even might agree with what the person is saying, but you feel compelled to disagree with them purely because of they're not allowing other people to have their own right to say or think what they want to say. And in effect, because of that, they're forcing you to choose sides, even though there's no it's not necessary to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, I mean, a lot of it is centered on this transgender thing. I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and this has never been anything really about transgender for me. It's really an issue of, like, I should be able to not, if I don't want to say something, I shouldn't be compelled to say it, and if I want to say something, I should be able to say it. That's just my basic principles there. So anyways, I was talking to a friend about this, and I was like, you know, if this sort of neo-transgender groups, if they were just cool about it, like, come over, hang out, let's have a pizza, let's get to know each other, and then when I start to warm up to you, if you go, look, I know this is a bit odd, but I don't really identify as a him or a her. Could you please say they, them, whatever? If that person has come at me with warmth and with an idea that I'm not already a bad guy, and just hung out and been like a congenial person, then I think the likelihood of me going, oh, okay, sure, I'll do my best, is much more likely than hi, you didn't know I existed, but unless you say these words now, you're a fascist. And then it just gets your back up, right? So there's a way to go about approaching this that is much more human and much more natural than here I am with this piece of legislation, do as I say or you will be getting fined or you'll lose your job, right? It's so much of it is about the approach.
And like you were saying, it's not even just some repercussions, it's also the labels that are attached to you, very harsh, stigmatized labels, such as, well, they're increasingly losing what they used to mean, but something like being called a fascist, for example, that's a pretty weighty term, and it's kind of just thrown around haphazardly, do you reckon?
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, that fascism, I mean, I'm a student of history, that's what I did my BA in, it was developed by Benito Mussolini specifically, and there's a whole, you can get it on Amazon for extremely cheap, the whole kind of foundations of fascism laid out by Mussolini, and it's a very specific thing, and it's mostly defined in opposition to classic liberalism, which is what I am. There's no way that you are using the term fascist right if you're using it against someone who supports free speech. It's almost like contrary. So it's not only expanding the term, it's completely using it inversely to mean the opposite of what it was constructed to oppose. You follow?
It's almost, I feel like it's so simplistic and reductionist now, it's almost used to describe someone who disagrees with you on pretty much anything.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think the irony is obvious that if you are the one who's compelling the speech and saying you also that you can't say these things, you're the authoritarian. It's not hard to figure out. And the frustrating part is like you can point to a political theory and say, look, no, you're using the words wrong. Like, this is where liberalism comes from. Like, this is the core beliefs of it. This is where fascism comes from. This is the core beliefs of it. You can explain it all, and at the end of the day, it just doesn't matter. It's I don't think that this is a war that can be won through reason, because like honestly, this is a chess game that you can win in about one move, right? So if the claim is people shouldn't be able to say things that are offensive, I can respond with, that thing that you just said was offensive, therefore you are no longer able to say it. Checkmate, right? So it's a self-negating idea. And because it's such an easy idea to counter, then they have to have a but, right? Dot, dot, dot. And that's where the ideology comes in. And that's where it's like, okay, but hold on. Because you belong to this group, now there's all these exceptions, which gets around logic and that little rule. And then we start getting into the use of sexism and racism and probably, you know, increasingly your sexuality or your gender orientation. And it's like, oh, so to give you an example, you know, you're a straight, white, cisgendered male, therefore the rules are different. Because you're an oppressor. You go, okay, but who have I oppressed? Like, well, historically, you have institutional power. It's like, no, I struggle to pay my bills to keep my apartment. I order a pizza and I watch Netflix. And, like, what institutional power? You have no link to any of this. This is just all a fantasy that you've made up in your head because you saw some... A group of rich CEOs, and most of them are old white men. Well, old is a big part of that. So it's almost like, how do I put it? It's like you can just keep repeating it ad nauseum. You can keep saying, well, my counter is that I find what you just said offensive, therefore you can't say it, therefore you can't have the opinion that changes my ability to express myself. And there really is no getting around that without the ideology. And you can keep repeating it, and it just doesn't sink in because they don't want it to sink in, because it's about having an asymmetry of power on their side, right? That's really what it is. It's like, well, I get to punch you, but you're not allowed to punch back, that kind of thing.
And it's what you're saying is, and I'm going to inject something else into this and see if it kind of fits, the irony of the situation of someone compelling you to speak and limiting your freedom of speech is only allowed because of the ideological principle of like a social constructionist perspective. That being that reality is subject to what you might deem appropriate. It's a kind of objective reality, and therefore race, power play, sexuality, etc. come right to the forefront now, because you can describe the world in a more like a conspiracy type way, in terms of like the patriarchy or whatever term you want to use, as an oppressive regime. And so you can quickly see how it spirals into, if you're oppressed in this world, well then the people oppressing you are going to be fascist, and so therefore anything that they say is negated by the fact that they're the evil ones, they're the fascists, and you're the righteous side because you've always been oppressed, and it's your time to kind of shine and be able to do what you need to do to get where you need to get to.
It's sort of reminiscent of when religion is used at its worst, right? It's all based on an invisible system which nobody can tangibly observe, and then it's like, well, you're the infidel, or whatever it is. Like patriarchy, how do I touch that? How do I measure that? Show me what that is. Like you can point to certain historical inequalities or stuff, but like now, where is it? What is that thing that you keep saying to justify all of these new measures to reinvent the world? Well, you're gonna have to show me what this is and the mechanism of it, you can't, right? That's the thing about this patriarchy. It's like, it exists, but it's invisible.
And the problem is, of course, is even the very idea of discussing this, like, what is it? Show me something tangible. That in itself is considered offensive now. It's untouchable. It's like an inquisition of types.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the fact is, they've just pushed it so far now that when you get to a point that you just can't win, that they've set up the rules on their side that you just can't win, then you, at some point, you just go, okay, well, I'm just going to say whatever I want all the time now, regardless of how many people it offends, or the repercussions it has for me, or even if it brings me at some point into, a violent conflict with someone. Like, what am I going to do? Just be bullied?
Yeah, roll over.
Roll over. There's no option. You've made it impossible. There's no space to maneuver here where I'm not a fascist. It's like you wish you want me to be the fascist. And once again, the irony of this is that's such a fascist tactic.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know what? That's a really great point, because, you know, in this strong desire to have this enemy, this perceived outgroup, the fascist, they've created one. They forced you to be the fascist by very nature of sticking up for yourself or fighting against oppressive values or limiting freedom of speech in any way. So in a sense, they've created their own outgroup to fight against, and now you're it.
That's pretty much it. And this was not anything that I paid attention to before. Like, I'm too busy. I've got lots of things I want to do with my life. I'm a very creative person. I'm interested in ideas, and I wasn't sitting around thinking about all the groups of people who I hate and want to oppress until they basically came and started shouting in my face and made me raise my eyebrow, right? That's the crazy part about it. And that comes back to what I was saying originally. Maybe there's something about your identity which is different. Well, okay. I'm pretty weird myself, so just come up and be cool, be chill, don't come at me like I'm some sort of attacker or that I've wronged you when I haven't, and just let's have a conversation and talk. And then if at some point, when it's obvious that we're connecting, we can have this other conversation about your unique identity and how I might have to change my language to accommodate it. You know, I have no problem with being civil, even if I don't agree with you. You know, and which I don't really even care, to be honest, too much about whether gender is related to biological sex. It's just not something that really occupies a great deal of my thought. I really care more about just the right to be able to exist in this world as an individual who's not constantly self-censoring and isn't ridden by anxiety, looking over their shoulders all the time, going and pre-thinking every word. Like, we're going to end up where everyone's stuttering, right?
Yep. And you know, it's a great point about the censoring. Is, you know, where does this leave us?
And so that leaves us in a place, as Jordan Peterson says, when you take dialogue off the table, you only have submission or violence. And I'm just not a submission type of person, but I'm not a violence person either. But you've given me those two options, I'm going to take violence. Terrible thing to have to discuss, isn't it?
Yeah,
to entertain the fact that, like, shit, like, really, is that what it's going to have to come to here? I don't want it to. But I'm also not going to be subjugated for, you know, especially considering that for most of my life I've been improving as a human being, I feel, and that becoming more tolerant and more open-minded, and then just all of a sudden out of the blue you're indicted because of your race, sexuality, gender. It's like you hear these talks about the evils of toxic masculinity and being there of a flexible term too. It's like, well, aren't you kind of being intolerant to a certain gender expression now? Like, once again, there's a hypocrisy in there. So, you know, if I like to drink a lot of booze and watch UFC and have a kind of conventional heteronormative relationship with my girlfriend, that's somehow bad. That's not allowed. That gender identity isn't allowed. Because I'm not saying that your gender identity isn't allowed. But you seem to have a problem with mine.
Yeah, and that's the whole, the only way they can get around the nature of what you're saying, the very distorted view of reality, or the whole hypocrisy of the whole thing, is a socially constructed view of reality, or that the whole thing is so set by the definitions of our past, historical inequality, and it continues to be pervasive in our everyday reality now, it justifies them persecuting you because you are not conforming to what they think is the way you should be.
Exactly. They're more invested in history than I am, and I'm a student of history. I'm pretty sure I know more about history than they are. The way I look at it, it's like, what do we have? We have now, right? We have, let's see, I was born in 1982, so I would have legally become an adult around the millennium. So we have everything after 2000 to work together and live in the now to maybe fix some of the past injustices without having to indict me for them. It's like this idea in Canada of you bear the burden of the terrible treatment of the indigenous people. It's like, well, I don't really. I just like to help them because they're other human beings in my society who seem to be treated unfairly, and they're at a number of disadvantages, and I'd like to work to stop that. So I'd like to be in my own time, the actual space of time that I'm living in, someone who's doing something good. But instead, you're making an enemy of me by bringing up things that ancestors I may not have even had did.
Yeah, and also, is it not better to have someone want to do something because they think it's right, as opposed to they're compelled to do it because of, well, reasons?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Because then the wronging just continues, right? Now it's another group forcing this other group based on history. Historically, people that looked like you did bad things, so now people that look like me are going to force you to do things, and that's bad. So then this wave of this trend of control and oppression is just perpetuated endlessly. And it's like, nah, chill out. Okay, look, everyone be calm. We're here. Things aren't perfect. But we have this time together here right now where we can just like stop slinging accusations at each other, stop demanding things of each other. And how about we just go, okay, what do we need to fix? What's wrong here? Now. Now, here in the present. Fuck what happened in the past. Right now. How can we all be good people? And that's the conversation I'm not hearing. It's just about... It's the baggage of history, which, it's... And I'm not even sure how complicit my ancestry is in this, and I don't think that many of us are, right? And I think there's also this real ignorance of history, too, in this sense that pretty much every people that are living in the world at the moment are walking on the bones of some civilization or people before them that their ancestors or they or whoever had to crush in order to get that land or those resources. It's not like this is an exclusive thing to one people, or that one people are guiltier than another of it. This is just a fact of history. But you have to know history to understand that. And if you're not taught a sort of objective view of history, if your history has this ideological tinge where it's, okay, class, history 101, we're going to start with how white people are evil and not mention the rest, not mention how European civilization, the good things they've done, not really look at the whole picture, but just focus in on this guilt part. Well, then you raise children to have a completely distorted view of history, and they carry that into adulthood, and they're sure that they're right, and that they're righteous, but the whole premises upon which they've built these opinions are completely false.
Yeah, you're right there. At some point down the line of history, every society or civilization is probably oppressed, assaulted, or otherwise hurt another society. There's just no way to escape that. That's how we formed countries and boundaries and whatnot. So where do you draw the line, I suppose? We're talking about the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, the British Empire. Why are we focusing primarily on, I suppose, Caucasian empires, as opposed to which have been massive in the past, like the Persian Empire, for example?
For sure. I'll even give you an example, which stuck out to me. It came up while I was doing research for a crime book. There's an indigenous group in Canada, and they're called the Slavey, and it's an interesting name, and this is how the name came about. So apparently, when the British came and spoke with the Cree, they asked them, what's the name of this other tribe? And the Cree, in Cree language, gave them the answer, the slaves, so that when it was interpreted to English, it became slavey. And the reason that the Cree referred to them as slaves is because they took them as slaves. Now, I'm not saying that this makes the Cree culture more evil or uniquely evil. I'm just saying that if you really look, there's dirt on everyone's hands. If the English language, okay, itself. So if you look at livestock, you have the names for livestock all have a Germanic origin. So just listen to the sounds of these, okay? Pig, chicken, cow, sheep, right? They don't sound very Roman, do they? How about mutton, mouton, right? Beef, pork is basically the same in French, just with a C. And so there's things built into the English language themselves where the people who are raising the livestock speak an Anglo-Saxon dialect, and the people who are eating it spoke French. Now, does that make me want to hate French people? Or, like, change the words of my language to erase this? Like, no, actually, I find it rather interesting. You know? Okay, that's the way it is. Yeah. We are homicidal super chimps. deal with much, it.
And you know what? This distortion of science or history is really, really important in terms of how we better understand where we came from and how to stop making the same mistakes we've always made in our past. There's two kind of tangents there which I think are really interesting. One of them, in terms of what you said with the super chimps, super homicidal chimps, I found this in my own doctorate. I was studying if chimps, mammals of any kind really, had the tendencies, as humans do, to go to war with one another. You know, purposefully wipe out another tribe or pack or whatever it is, just so that they can gain more land or more resources or whatever. And I found myself caught in this ideological battle between a couple of Ivy League universities trying to decipher if chimps actually do commit warfare against each other or actively kill one another. And it was ideological in the sense that originally when we looked at it, we saw that apes or chimps do go into conspecific killing, that is, kill one another or kill different tribes to gain more territory. And, you know, you can see this over a 25, 30 year, 50 year even period. They actively go out on hunts with units. They patrol, and if they find one that's weaker than them, they will kill them, and they will take them. And they'll often kill the children, offspring as well, and keep the females. But then this became ideological. They started to argue about, well, is it the chimps that are doing this, or have we as humans forced them into this type of awareness or environment by constricting the amount of land they have or volume they have or how we even measure warfare? Or, you know, it became less about the science, what I'm trying to say, and more about what does it mean if we're saying chimps are willing to kill each other, what does that mean about humans and our nature? I think that's where the argument was going.
I think it's a bit of an asinine question, because it's like, well, have we artificially taken away the chimps? Have we restricted their environment, forcing them to do this? Okay, well, it's the question makes sense, but you have to also understand that these variables happen to humans too. Just because humans didn't necessarily cause them, and sometimes they did, right? Like, I mean, the Huns were just placed by the Mongols and such, right? You understand the history of the Dark Ages, all this migration west. With the Goths and everything, this was all the kind of toughest group moving in the east and forcing all the others to the west. And so humans ourselves place restrictions on which force us to into war situations. But not only that, nature does also, right? Through disease, through natural disasters, through just flux, things change. And it's shown that when things change, that human beings are willing to wage war and commit acts of violence in order to survive and adapt to that. So the fact that chimps do, because we've placed them in a restricted environment, it doesn't change the nature. It doesn't change the reality that the nature of chimpanzees is that they will react to that with violence.
Yeah, and I think the argument that they're worried about making is, well, if chimps can do this, if it's innate in them, then it presumably could be innate in us, this ability to commit warfare or to kill one another for land, territory, whatever. And I think that's where the ideology was, in terms of they don't want the idea that humans are innately violent creatures. They want the idea that we have been forced to be violent through oppressive hierarchies and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. But then the interesting thing is when we come back to, okay, well, let's look at these oppressive hierarchies and how they work. This whole theory just then, as we have seen, it just manifests in a new type of oppression and a new power game, right? So it didn't liberate anyone by highlighting these power hierarchies, whether real or, you know, imagined or delusional. All that's being done now is that these hierarchies are being used to justify one population controlling another again, except this time it's like, you can't have an opinion on this, because of your position in this perceived position in this invisible hierarchy. And so it didn't even change things. It didn't get rid of the violence and the need to control. It just shifted the form of it.
And, you know, this is going to be controversial, what I'm about to say. But when we're looking at nomadic tribes, or should we say pre-Bronze Age, I guess Stone Age type tribes that we've encountered throughout colonization, there seems to be this idea to put them on a pedestal as if they are somehow exempt from violent behavior, or they themselves have not wiped out other similar tribes in order to gain land or territory. And I'm trying to get my head around it. I found this in my doctorate, actually. There's a lot of talk about Eskimo tribes, or Canadian Inuit tribes, or Australian Aboriginal tribes. And it seems like we can't have a sensible conversation about it anymore because of the nature that of the reality that they currently live in. As you were saying before, a lot of them are very poor or in very difficult and hard situations, and therefore we can't have a serious discussion about what their ancestors were like, because for some reason it's off topic or considered taboo, because it feels like just understanding the history as objective as we can means that we're somehow blaming them or being a racist.
Right. A great example of this is, if you bring up the fact that, like the slave trade, I don't know how most people think that worked. I'm talking specifically about the slave trade from Africa to the Americas, right? Because that's funny. That's like sometimes that's the only type of slavery that people seem to consider. Not that slavery has been all over the globe in like so many cultures. It's like, once again, that slavery is somehow unique to kind of the last 600 years of Western civilization. But I think people's understanding of that or something is that there were Portuguese people patrolling the African coasts with nets and catching poor black people in nets and putting them in cages. And it's like, well, not really. Most of the slaves were already enslaved by other African tribes that had conquered their tribes. And so these other Africans sold the slaves to, be it the Portuguese or the British or the Spanish or the French, whatever have you. So the idea that this is exclusively the sin or responsibility of a white people is, once again, it's just ahistorical. And the reason I bring up that example is off your point that you just made. It's like it's taboo to discuss that, or it's like trying to deflect. I'm like, no, those people that those white people that traded those slaves and bought them, they are fully responsible for those despicable actions. But if we edit the story to leave out the origins of where how the slaves were acquired in the first place, it's just intellectually dishonest, and it just continues to distort our understanding of what it is to be all kind of guilty as humans. And as our ancestors, we're always there isn't one group, it's us all, because we're the same species, right? Ultimately, we're all historically, as I said, have blood in our hands. And I think the sooner that we come to recognize this and go, okay, well, that was the past, because we understand the past, we can take it and we can place it over in this area, and now we can look at the present. Okay, so let's forget about right now what skin color you are, or whatever, or what sex you are, or gender, or religion. Like, here we are right now. We have the unique opportunity to not be assholes. We've understood history and seen that it was full of assholes. So let's make a conscious decision not to do that now and to get along. But that means admitting to the full picture of the past, that there isn't one group of perpetrators, that really, if you look across the globe and all through history, you just see terrible acts of violence and inhumanity and power struggles.
And you know, that's a great point. Why do we have to change the narrative of our past, our history, in order to move forwards and make better decisions?
I think because we haven't learned from it. We still want there to be good guys and bad guys, and that for somehow, because it's easy too, isn't it? It's easy to say, well, you know, you're a bad guy, and I'm a victim because of the past. All that requires is the uttering of some words. But for us to be actively all trying to be constructive and benevolent and good in the present, that's a lot of hard work and commitment. And if we devote ourselves to that, it's going to show that certain individuals are actually, they still are pieces of shit, right? And what I don't mean is any ethnicity or race or sexuality. I'm talking specifically about individuals, right? There's always going to be those people. And I think that, so there's a fear of that, if there's a demand upon us right now to actively get involved in making the present better so that the future can be improved, that we can't hide behind things like these identity categories anymore. It really comes down to, what are you doing? What are you doing to make the world a better place right now?
And it's also what you're saying is, it makes it more nuanced. And as we know, people, psychologically speaking, find nuance quite tricky. People prefer to make things put or fit into nice, easy categories or groups to make sense of the world. And so what you're saying is, it would be a great deal more difficult. You're going to have to engage your brain in some critical thinking, some understanding of history, and how to move forward, instead of just, well, this is what you've told me is true, and so therefore this is how reality is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it means that we all have to accept responsibility for the moment, not responsibility for some distorted past.
And another psychological point about what you said before about essentially being forced to be compassionate towards people just based on something that your ancestors may or may not have done, instead of taking ownership for your behavior now because it's the right thing to do. When you are forced to be compassionate, or forced in any kind of behavior really, as an adult, you become resentful. And when you become resentful, you immediately begin to feel trapped. And when you feel trapped, you have absolutely no choice but to start obsessing about, how do I get out from this trap? How do I seek freedom again? And in a very real way, this is a psychological prison that you're kind of forced into. And you're going to, even if your behavior would have been the same, but because you weren't allowed to get there on your own terms, or because it was the morally right thing to do, because you feel like you've been compelled to do this behavior, you're going to attempt to escape. And then you're going to behave in a way which is going to make people angry, and therefore you're the outgroup again.
This brings me back to a time I had in elementary school where I guess just one day they decided that we were going to start celebrating Earth Day. And I'm the kind of person that you can't just pull something out of the blue like that and go, okay, everyone, we're doing this now. And it's like, okay, well, why wasn't it like that last year, or, you know, the year before that? And they marched us all out into a field, and they had us link hands in a circle around a sapling that they had just planted, and start singing songs I'd never heard before, with lyrics I'd never heard before, about Mother Earth, which, as if it was like an anthropomorphized version of Mother Earth. And I was just getting hit with, like, I need an explanation. This seems like bullshit. What's going on? At so many levels, I kept getting hit and hit and hit by it, that being the little bastard I was, I just started singing the lyrics backwards, so they sounded kind of like satanic, right? So it was like, Niharu, ba 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 ba, and then it was the same old thing, Lee, go to the office. And it just, you know, on the surface, it just seems like I'm being a prick. But what it really was is, I think it was a kind of more curious and intelligent child going, well, hold on, what's all this new stuff? Like, how did we arrive at this decision to all get together and do this? And, you know, this places me in opposition to Earth Day, when really I have a very vested interest in the Earth being a healthy climate for me, right? But it was the kind of coerced, you just have to do it way that it was brought to me, which made me have that reaction. Yeah, just as a child, like intuitively, and then working it out later as an adult. Like, why did I do that? And then realizing, you know, it was something about intuition. I remember hearing Sam Harris speak about intuition and how valuable it is, because a lot of the times what it is you're picking up on things very quickly. You're noticing inconsistencies or strange things, but your brain doesn't have the time to logically process them, so you just get a feeling that something's not quite right. And I think that's probably how this feels a lot with the compelled pronouns or any sort of limitations on free speech. For many people, they can't logically break it down. Your average citizen can't logically break down what's wrong with it. But they get an intuitive feeling that things are changing and that it's not necessarily for the better. And they don't necessarily have the ability to articulate in a reasonable way what it is they find objectionable about it. So they'll make appeal to a traditional tradition arguments like, hold on, like, you know, it's always been like this. Why is it like this now? And that's not, it's not that they're necessarily incorrect in being suspicious. It's just that they're being confronted suddenly with a new situation, which they only know through intuition seems to be wrong. Whereas, and this may come across as a little bit elitist, but as I said, I'm already in a corner now, and, you know, I've got to spend the rest of my life apologizing or just go fuck you, so I'm just going to say it. Those of us who are, who do spend more time reading, who are kind of a bit more intellectual, we can parse it apart and we can see logically what the problems are. Although it may start with an intuitive feeling for us, I believe we are quickly, because of our skill set, able to sort of break it down and see what it is.
Absolutely. That actually brings us to the next section, which it depends if you think we have time to discuss it, the Lindsay Shepherd debacle going on. Is it in Canada? It is in Canada, isn't it?
Yeah, it's at Laurier. Now, this is something I'm not completely well informed in, because at the same time I'm writing a number of books and doing all kinds of stuff. But hey, let's have the conversation, and just anyone listening after this point, if I get some facts wrong, just please forgive me. It just popped up. So let's do this.
If it devolves into some kind of mess, I'll just edit it out if neither of us make any sense. And so just to clarify then, the Lindsay Shepherd debacle is what's going on at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada?
Yeah.
That's right. And she's a TA there. And as far as I'm aware, she was teaching either in a seminar or a lecture about grammar. And during this time, she decided to show a very small clip of a debate on national Canadian television between Jordan Peterson and someone else about compelled use of pronouns. To my understanding, she introduced this stuff neutrally, so she did not say whether she agreed with him or disagreed with him. She showed around 4.5-minute clip, and then afterwards they had a discussion about how compelled pronouns may fit grammatically when forming sentences. So after this, she was called in to an office. It's all public domain now. You can pretty much find this on YouTube if you just type in Lindsay Shepherd. And what I considered to what happened is she was bullied by her senior lecturer, or I guess in university terms you call it her manager or her supervisor. She was bullied for like an hour and a half by that person and someone else with a title that's so ridiculous I can't even remember it. Do you remember the title of the other person?
No, I don't care.
Yeah, fair enough. I'll go with that as well. So people can have a listen to see what they can make of the bullying, but essentially what happened is, because she discussed it in an or she introduced it neutrally, this was considered abhorrent or akin to introducing Hitler objectively or neutrally. And
I have a problem with, by the way.
Pardon?
I mean, I've shown clips, I believe, in classes I've taught of Nazis and stuff in the past, and I'm not sure that I followed up with, and they're evil, what a bunch of assholes. I guess I just assumed that most people knew that.
Yeah, and I guess the argument the lecturers were making is it's all very new. The students are just become adults themselves, and it's up to the university to guide them to appropriate thinking, and this is where it gets really muddy. Appropriate thinking, what does that even mean? And so Lindsay Shepherd's argument was, well, look, they're adults, I'm introducing them to this topic, they can make up their own minds, and we can have a debate about it. She actually doesn't entirely agree with Jordan Peterson's view on compelled pronouns either, but that's neither here nor there, apparently, according to her senior lecturer. So anyway, he essentially told her that what she did was committing violence against people who may have felt threatened or upset or offended during this this lecture or seminar because she did not denounce him immediately or speak to him, like I said, as akin to someone like Adolf Hitler. Now, what do you would you have like a short summary of what you think about the whole thing?
I'll just tell you that I almost showed that clip in my own social problems class that I was teaching, and we were doing one on gender, and as it was a current debate that was happening in Canada at the time of the class, I thought that it was relevant to play the video in class, and we probably would have discussed it. However, because I tend to go off on little tangents, because I do discuss things with my students, I believe in an open classroom where ideas are shared and we hear each other's points and we try to arrive at the right answer, and if we can't, well, whatever, you know, we act civil. Because I do that so much, I didn't have time to play the video. So, I mean, I could have been Lindsay Shepherd, and I might have even given my opinion on it. I might have even played devil's advocate, right? Like, that's a good way of teaching sometimes, is to sometimes, even if you don't agree with an opinion, let's say that one of your students is giving an opinion that you agree with, But to test them and make them stronger, you can take the other side of it and go, aha, but what about this, this, and this, right? And then they have to be able to counter those questions. So this is my understanding of how a classroom is supposed to work. It's not a one-way monologue of brainwashing. It is a dialogue, and student and professor sort of strengthen each other through the exchange of ideas.
I think that's a really nice way of looking at it.
Yeah. It's like when you have let's use the Game of Thrones reference here, okay? You have Arya and you have her dancing master who's teaching her how to use the sword, right? It's not just if you're going to show her how to use the sword, you don't just beat on her with your own sword and just not show her like anything, right? Like it's a back and forth. It's a two way, right? And over time they get better at making logical arguments and thinking things through more critically. And if all you're doing is just downloading some ideology, like this is the correct view, on your students, then you're not doing anything to make them stronger. They're never improving as sword fighters in the analogy I just made. They're never getting better.
And I think the bigger problem with this whole issue is the senior lecturer had made a decision already before talking to her that Jordan Peterson's objectively wrong. And somehow he or his faculty hold the reins of objective truth of what's acceptable and unacceptable. And the reason for that is because they sit in a position where words are violent and ideas are violent, and they're trying to protect the students from this violence, from this pain and suffering or hurt. And so I think because of that, they feel quite certain that what they're doing is correct, instead of the alternative side, which I guess doesn't have such a strong ideological bent, is suggesting that, well, maybe if words and ideas aren't inherently violent, You don't need to be protecting student funders. In fact, it makes them stronger to hear ideas that are confusing, scary, or you know, bring up some things inside of them. And that's, as you were saying, makes them grow stronger as a thinker.
I think you can see how terrible these sort of, I don't even want to call them thinkers, these professors that were criticizing Lindsay Shepherd, this is how poor they are at thinking. So Jordan Peterson is objectively wrong, but reality is a social construct.
Yeah. Good point.
Right, so no one's a serious thinker here. This is all just a power play. It's a stupid fucking game. And that's what you've got to call it out as. And, you know, at some point, when someone is just being completely arguing in bad faith, and they're being dishonest with you and dishonest with themselves, at some point, you know, you have to just call it out, and you have to be impolite, and you have to go, no, you're obviously, you're contradicting logic. This is math, man. This is, you're making one claim, and then you're rebutting your own argument, and you're experiencing no cognitive dissonance. Like, are you stupid or just evil? What is it?
Yep. That's a really good point about cognitive dissonance. How can you not be feeling the cognitive dissonance based on what you are projecting? If you don't feel it, you're either unaware that the two ideas are conflicting, or you feel like you're above the conflict, as you said, which I suppose you could look at as evil.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that when you're exercising power over someone's life in a malevolent way based upon a deception, I would classify that as a sort of evil, you know, in a non metaphysical sense of the term, but just in, you know, an everyday parlance use of the word.
This is what keeps me up at night. How did these people get into the position they are? Not just because, obviously, ideological principles at university, but how did they get through the PhD or the doctorate phase, and then perhaps a postdoc? You've got to develop quite a thick skin to get through that review process, as you know. How did they get there with this kind of way of thinking?
I think I've got it. I think I've got this figured out, right? So dialogue isn't allowed. You're not allowed to challenge your professor's views. And certainly, if you're violent, that's not going to get you anywhere. So they must be constantly submitting. Anytime that they have some doubt about what the professor is saying, they just go, oh, the professor must be right, or it's not worth it for me to question them, so I'll just repeat what they want me to say. And then this just becomes a cognitive habit and a social habit until it's almost like, Jesus, it's almost like child molestation, where the pattern recurs in the victim, right? And they go on to perpetrate.
So do you feel like, in a sense, they become like a prisoner to their own or to their professor's ideas?
Yes, at first. Yeah, they submit fully to the complete ideological molestation of their professors. And then at some point, by doing that and by never opposing it, they're allowed to move through the ranks for being a good little, you know, being good and compliant. And then they get to rise to the role of being perpetrator and then doing that ideological molestation to another group of students until you end up with a bunch of damaged people. And I'm sorry for using such a crass metaphor, but it just occurred to me at the moment that, you know, it does feel somewhat like that. It's got a similar sliminess to it.
I guess then the question is asked, how did their professors get to that point?
So where did the first corruption begin?
I guess it's a stupid question because there's no way to answer it, but what I mean is, I said, you know, how do I get through the PhD process? And you quite rightly pointed out, well, the supervisor has a lot of power and authority over you. It really isn't worth it a lot of the time to upset the apple cart when you're throwing around ideas and they have a very strong disagreement with you. Well, you're in a little bit of a bad situation there. You can disagree with them and potentially find yourself screwed over when it comes to the review process and to find yourself another supervisor, grants. up in the air with all this. It's complicated and difficult. Sometimes it is either just to go along with it, just to get through the PhD. So I get that. I think you're really right there. But then, you know, it makes me wonder, well, how the hell did their professor get through the PhD process and come to these ideological certainties and then feel compelled to preach to the people below them?
Yeah, and that's why I use the sort of, I guess, quite controversial idea of you know, comparison to child molestation, where the victim, after a while, just takes on the same mental pathology as the perpetrator. And of course, I'm not saying that all do, right? I've got to clarify that. But we see that a lot of victims of sexual abuse as children go on to commit sexual abuse against children themselves. Not the majority, but enough, right? And it's almost like that they get infected by that same corrupt desire, corrupt thought, right? Or set of thoughts. I think also too that people try to avoid conflict at all points. Like, I'll see this even just going on the subway. People intuitively know this about each other. So you'll have someone that is, they'll be sitting on a seat on the subway and they've got their purse on the seat beside them, and you walk up and you stand there, you know, obviously wanting to take a seat, and they'll avoid making eye contact with you, even though they clearly know that you're there wanting to sit down. And what they're banking on is that you won't want to enter a conflict situation with them, because most people find conflict uncomfortable, right? And so that's why so much of this happens, is that you'll get somebody taking up two seats on the subway or whatever, because people are averse to conflict, and maybe are increasingly averse to conflict as we get more and more alienated and poor in our social skills as a result of this sort of information age that we're living in, and the isolation that comes along with it. And so perhaps this is what it is. It's just people wishing to avoid conflict, and they want the job, and they want the doctorate, and they want the authority more than they want pride and ownership of themselves. This reminds me of a quote actually by Nietzsche. It's like something like, the individual has always had to struggle to keep from being overwhelmed by the tribe. If you try, you will be lonely, often and sometimes frightened, but no price is too high to pay for the privilege of owning yourself. Right? There's not many people that live by that. Almost no one.
Very true. Especially about the trying to avoid conflict. Most human beings will avoid conflict like the plague.
Yeah, exactly. Because at some point we got into a place where it was like, like with people who are that pathological liars, right? I'll give them as an example. There's people that lie pathologically, and everyone knows it. And I'm the kind of person, personally, that I'll call them out on. I'll be like, why are you saying that story again? We know it didn't happen. What is this habit that you're in? Why do you keep lying? It makes me not trust you. It makes me not want to be around you. Just be cool. Just tell the truth. We don't expect anything from you. And at some point, it's like being the guy that calls out the pathological liar is more rude than being a pathological liar.
Yeah.
Because you're putting conflict into the room. It's like, no, I'm pointing to the elephant in the room here. So the emperor doesn't have any clothes on. I don't know. Do you think it's always been like this? Is this some sort of post-industrial bourgeois phenomenon, or have human beings always been this willing to avoid conflict and just completely agreeable and, oh, just let him be like that, it's just the way he is?
That's an interesting question. I think you're probably right. Possibly is post-industrial in the sense of, you know, when we have the privilege of being able to set up society and a facade of society, you know, where there's more money now and we're you've got some relative security in your life, then I guess you have the privilege and time to set up these little social constraints, and people don't want that tampered with. And so therefore they're going to avoid tampering with it by entering into conflict with one another.
Yeah, it actually, it brings me to, have you heard of Irving Goffman? Yeah, Goffman's great. So one of the points where I disagree with Jordan Peterson is that he kind of land-based sociology as a whole, kind of, but just focusing on post-structuralism, right? He's like, sociology is this corrupt, useless discipline because of post-structuralism. It's like, well, you know, maybe that's what it's largely become. There's also a lot of insights in sort of the more classical sociology before the post-structuralism, and Goffman is a great example of this, just how in day-to-day life, there's sort of like these social expectations, and how we're all in a situation together, we're constantly working to define the situation in a way that's agreeable to all parties. And so we adopt a line, as he calls it, which is sort of like a way of acting in that situation. And we never want to be in wrong face, which would be calling out the pathological liar, right? That's to be in wrong face. You're messing with the definition of the situation. You also don't want to be out of face, which is just kind of this stuttering wreck, just paralyzed by anxiety, not knowing what to say, not knowing what to do, just being awkward, right? It's like there's this sort of social expectation in certain situations that one is supposed to act according to like these rules that we're all supposed to know, and that to deviate from that is vulgar. You know, it's about the politeness of the situation and making the situation function so that all parties are satisfied. But that's only for people who make agreement and lack of conflict in a social situation their number one priority, yeah. Right? And I think some of us just aren't like that. I want to be having real interactions with people.
I think in terms of why some people are like that and some people aren't, obviously that's a complicated question. I think from a psychological perspective, in terms of, well, what was your upbringing? What was your, you know, are there genetic markers predisposing you to a personality traits that perhaps allow you to be able to absorb or take on more threatening stimuli without freaking out? I think there's a lot to it to unpack in order to take that a little bit further. I wouldn't even know where to begin, to be honest.
Well, immediately the five-factor model of personality comes up. My profile is, I have a rather unique profile, so my openness is 100%, 100. So I'm as open-minded as you can be. But my agreeableness is 13. And, you know, that really gave me a lot of self-insight. It was kind of like, why am I coming into conflict with people so often? Like, what is it? And it's the combination of those two things. And being slightly more extroverted than introverted. So not just shutting up about it, right? So there's that too. I think there's a cultural factor as well. Like, so for me, my family's from the northwest of England, quite good at shooting each other down, right? Hardly polite society, kind of working class culture. So there could be that as well. But I would think that culture is, you know, maybe less of it than genetics. That seems to be the trend now, right? That it's our genetics that are more of an influence on the way that we act.
It's difficult to strike up the balance with the environment which you grow up in and genetic markers, because obviously your genes can change and express themselves in different ways as depending on your environment. And we know for certain that your brain adapts to its environment as well. And that really throws everything out, because, you know, let's just say, well, it's impossible to really know. We don't really have a way to compare, but let's just say we had two identical people and one grew up in a war-torn environment and the other one in an upper echelon privileged society. Presumably, they would develop in very different ways because of the brain has had to develop differently in order to survive its environment. And that's, I suppose, well, you can argue that anxiety has obviously genetic components. Certain it does, yeah. But it would be very difficult to suggest that you wouldn't develop a form of anxiety or maybe another coping mechanism, hypervigilance of one way or another, in order to deal with this very difficult environment. But what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because let's just say, I dealt with quite a few soldiers with my PhD, and some of them had really rough upbringings, like really rough. And there's really a few ways you can go when you have such a rough upbringing. You can go inward, you can become extremely hypervigilant, anxious, avoid conflict at all costs. Or you could do what some of them do, and I'm certain this must have been through personality reasons. They become like what you call the sheepdog, which is everyone's running away from the fire, they will run towards the fire, see what the hell's going on, see who they can protect, they see the world in a much more black and white way. You know, you're good, you're bad, you're someone I'm going to be able to kill, because that's just the way it goes, and I'm going to be okay with that. I will protect people, I won't run away from conflict, because conflict doesn't scare me. In actual fact, when I come to conflict, my brainwaves change. I go into the zone in a way that most people don't. When most people get into conflict, they freak out. You know, they're not used to it. Their brainwaves go all over the place. So it's a complicated issue, but you're probably right. There is a heavy genetic component to it.
What portion of people do you think run toward the fire?
I guess that depends on, let's just say we're calling it sort of like a subclinical psychopathy.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's call it that, because I call it that because I guess when you're thinking about what it requires for you to be able to do that, you know, two people are playing chicken and one person, no matter what, is not going to bend. They're expecting the other person to bend. That's possibly the subclinical psychopath. You know, and that's the one who does so well in life. You know, we know psychopaths maybe make up 4% of the population. The subclinical ones, though, we have no idea, because they form all echelons of society from, you know, investment bankers, Wall Street, you know, special forces soldiers. I don't even know where to begin with trying to understand those numbers. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we can even come close to knowing. And also, too, I mean, what we're discussing here is there's people that run towards the fire that are still very moral, right? And they may just run into the fire and get burnt. But the thing about the successful psychopaths is that they're also very deceptive people, right? They use charm and manipulation and will lie freely and easily. And to kind of slide their way to the top. So their lack of fear and their sort of cognitive empathy is what is part of it. But if you don't have the will or ability to be deceptive, it can only get you so far. In fact, it can get you into a lot of trouble, right? So yeah, so I think that in some ways then we might start, you know, the whole issue of psychopathy, that's just a fascinating one. Because now they talk about how there's like these primary psychopaths and secondary psychopaths, right? And the primary psychopaths are more what we just talked about. So they're people with affective deficits. So, lack of empathy and remorse, failure to accept responsibility for actions, you know, shallow affect, and then also a lot of these sort of interpersonal manipulation skills. Whereas the secondary psychopath tends to be more impulsive, thrill-seeking, parasitic, and I think that they've mapped those to different parts of the brain, which, so the primary psychopathic traits seem to be concentrated mostly in the amygdala, and the secondary, like failures in the amygdala, and the secondary ones are in the prefrontal cortex. but those are joined by the limbic system, right? So you can have like varying degrees of decay going from one through the limbic system to the other. What I mean by that is like white matter. Or you can have it localized and not in another part of the brain. Anyways, and sorry, kind of going off on the tangent here, you just got me thinking.
It makes a lot of... Now, that's really interesting, and, you know, we could absolutely do a whole thing on acquired psychopathy or psychopathy, or, as you were saying, primary or secondary psychopathy. Is it, in fact, a whole disorder, or is it separate disorders? I heard one person recently, with an interview with Sam Harris, I forget his name, and he's completely skeptical about the idea of psychopathy at all. He just says, I think we're just talking about assholes, subclinical assholes, and people who are just thrill seekers.
Yeah, but I mean, if you can see, if you can measure consistently patterns in the brain that result in asshole, like whether we call them asshole or psychopath, right? Like, to me, it all comes down to, is there a neuroscience behind it? If there isn't, then we're just talking about personality that is somehow unrelated. But now I'm journeying into waters that I really shouldn't be. I don't know enough about the brain.
I think you know enough to cover what we were just describing, the white matter, limbic system, amygdala, pretty much the main part of it, is if we're not delving to the hardcore neuroscience of which none of us are equipped to do.
Yeah, no. And that's, I mean, that's one of the things you get, what do they call it, charlatan syndrome, right? It's like, I would probably have no issue whatsoever lecturing to a bunch of, to my class or some people in a public library about this kind of thing off the top of my head. But knowing that there's probably going to be psychologists and neuroscientists that may listen to this podcast, there's a part of me going like, nah, dial it back, stick to your history and your five-factor model shit, dude, you know?
I'm on board with that. I'll agree with that if you agree with that.
Yeah. So that's as far as we'll go. And if I'm completely wrong about some of that stuff, cool. My bad.
Yeah. Good disclaimer.
You can't know everything, right? But that's the thing, too. I mean, this is about... isn't it nice to be able to have free discourse where you and I can, like, without worrying too much about who's going to be listening to this and, oh my, what will they think and, you know, will they value this? Am I going to be a person that rises to a certain level of respect in them? Just the ability to freely interact with another human being and just shoot out ideas. And you know what I mean? It's like, it's healthy. It's healthy for our mutual psychologies, for our sociability, to be able to exchange ideas like this. And this is what I don't like about this whole control, whether it's compelled or restrained speech, is that you're taking away my ability and your ability to have this kind of conversation. Because, you know, every sentence the policeman's going to come in and blow a whistle and say like, no, you just used a term which is politically incorrect. You get fined. No, that's an illegal idea. No, there you weren't completely right. Therefore, you're an idiot, right? There's this real policing of just dialogue between people that seems to be occurring in the modern age. You see it a lot on Twitter too, right? Like, you have like 140 characters to make a point. Well, now you've got twice as much. So, which I prefer, by the way, I'm finding a lot easier. But when you had 140 characters, you couldn't get into the nuances of things at all. So then you get these people that come along and they miss the bigger picture of your argument and just focus on one word where you didn't specify enough what you were talking about and just want to nitpick at that, and then you'd explain it to them and then they wouldn't let it go. It's like they just wanted you to be wrong and for them to look smarter than you. Did you ever get any of that?
All the time, and the worst thing about that is even if 90% of your argument was solid, that 10% or 5% or whatever it is something, as you said, they're going to just constantly hammer you on to the point then when they discuss the idea in the future, they'll say you were wrong. because you use the wrong word. One comes to mind pretty quick. I was discussing the idea of a baker refusing service to a gay couple for their gay wedding. That whole big, I'm not sure if you remember, the whole big Dave Rubin thing.
Yeah, I think that's happened so many times now that it's just sort of an idea more incident to me, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you follow the general theory, and I was discussing with someone the back and forth of, well, what does it mean to prevent that person from expressing their religious freedom by saying, look, I'm not going to make you a cake for a gay wedding, but you know, go to another bakery, tell your friends to go to another bakery and shut them down. And somehow this got into the topic of Google and YouTube, and they were saying, well, look, how can you say a baker has freedom of expression and to do and say what they like, but you're telling me that YouTube or Google can't do the same with their own ideological principle? And I said, well, look, the difference there is YouTube and Google have a virtual monopoly on the situation. Like, if we're talking about a virtual monopoly baker who owns like 99% of all bakeries, and you cannot get to another bakery within 1,000 miles, something ridiculous like that, then yeah, you probably have a good point there, that's kind of affecting your quality of life. I mean, I know we're talking about something ridiculous like baking, but you follow my point.
Yeah.
And I said, but with YouTube and Google, you really have very limited options on where you can go with this virtual monopoly. And of all the whole conversation we had, maybe 10 or 15 tweets, their reply was, Google and YouTube do not fit the parameters for a monopoly, and then proceeded to correct me for another 5 or 6 tweets about how I was incorrect about what a monopoly means, and then explained to me the alternatives to Google and YouTube, completely missing the whole point of the argument, and also preventing us from actually having any meaningful dialogue, because now we're just muddying through the waters of terms. What does capitalism mean? What does it mean to have a monopoly on something? What do I mean by monopoly? Can a monopoly be used in this day and age when we're talking about Google and YouTube, which hasn't really caught up with how much power YouTube has in suppressing voices or amplifying voices? And, you know, we just got way off topic, and I think you're right. I think it's done on purpose.
Yeah, that's it. And then sometimes you can even say, like, yeah, you know, I probably should have used a different word there. You know, forgive me, I have a character limitation, and then the cool people will acknowledge that and just trust you with it and allow the discussion to continue, or if the discussion has naturally resolved, you just go your separate ways without bad feelings. But then there's those people that they just want to, like, you'll concede, you'll be like, yeah, okay, in that particular instance, I should have been more specific. And I actually meant this. And then they'll be like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. And just wanting to always bring it to a place of the endless argument where at some point you're just supposed to, I guess, say, you're right, I'm a really stupid person that shouldn't have a Twitter account, and you're smarter than me because I wasn't completely specific and considered every single variable in this situation, right? And I think that comes down to maturity too, right? Are you discussing things with people and having dialogues because you're still in high school and you like mentally, and you want to be the winner? You want to be the guy who stands smugly atop of all the other people that you're discussing with and go, smartest, look at me, smartest? Or are you doing it to, once again, better the world, or to have some sort of human connection? And for me, it's the second. Like, I just came to terms with the fact that, you know, there's probably 100 million people at least that are smarter than me, and, you know, at least. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I shouldn't express my opinion. It's just like the same way when you're a little kid. I think every young boy has this fantasy that they, at some point, that they can kick the ass of everyone else in the world, right? And then life comes in and you go, oh, wait, no, that's not true. And then you get older and you're like, oh, no, that's really not true. And then it just sinks in, right? But the same should happen with your intelligence. And then when you develop that kind of maturity, you start to become more civil. And your discourse doesn't become about winning. It becomes about the value of exchanging ideas.
I agree with you. It made me think of the term social justice warrior very carefully. Actually, I think it takes on a different meaning for me anyway, probably from my studying of warriors, but the term social justice warrior is really, really apt based on what we were just discussing, because their aim is not just to have a civil discussion with you, their aim is to win and destroy you. You know, what's the nth degree here to their point? You know, if they're a warrior, you're the out-group, they're the in-group. There's no way for you guys to meet in the middle in their eyes. You're the enemy, and they will destroy you at any cost. And it makes me think, what's the nth degree, like what you're saying, that you just deactivate your Twitter account, apologize, submit to their will at all costs? Is that what winning is to them? I just don't rightly know.
Yeah, that you just disappear, you know, that your opinion is crushed. And I'm not, you know, I'm someone that I've changed my opinion greatly on many things over the course of my life. That's something to be proud of, by the way. Over the course of your life, you consider things and you weigh things, you get more knowledge and more life experience, and your opinions sort of evolve.
I feel like for them, accepting that they were wrong is admitting failure, weakness, and defeat.
Yeah, and that's why people who spend so much time arguing with them, they say never apologize, like never admit wrong about something. And I guess this comes back to what we were discussing before, right? If you say, yeah, you're right, I didn't exactly phrase that correctly, or, you know, I could have been more specific on that concept, forgive me, I had a limitation of time or words or something like that. You know, it's not like, okay, I understand then, but now that we've clarified that, we can move forward with the conversation. It's like, aha, I found an admission of weakness, and I'm just going to keep needling at it. And so that is, that's like a sort of, it's a verbal exchange that is not done in the spirit of trying to find a solution or trying to reach a synthesis or even realizing, hey, we see the world in different ways, but, you know, let's just part for now. That's like a no, I've got to obliterate your reputation. My argument for why limiting free expression, like that one move checkmate, as far as I can tell, that's pretty much invincible. So just to repeat it, it's people shouldn't say things that offend other people. Response, that statement offends me, therefore you can't say it. Your own idea cancels each other out. So from that point of view, from a logical point of view, I don't think there's much more to be said. But what really I think is so tragic about this is, and this is more pervasive than just in our expression. I mean, you can see this, I think, going increasingly over into the human sexual experience, too. But, like, there's a joy of a free flow and uninhibited dialogue and an experimentation with another human being or group of human beings, right? Just the ability to just jam out on an idea or just run with something and just be social and not have to have feelings of shame or anything attached to that. And I think there's the trend in our culture has moved away from that. You know, it's like we're living in there was an echo of the 60s. The pendulum swung from the 60s, and now we're sort of in this neo-Victorian period, which was an expression that I had started using, and I heard Camille Paglia use it recently, and I think that's really, it's not perfect, but it's a very close approximation to where we are right now. We're living in a kind of neo-Victorian type culture. Everyone's very easily offended. There's a lot about censorship, and people are completely obsessed with race.